Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames, and the surrounding area, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area. Today, we have three co-hosts, Paul Wearson, Gina McAndrews, and myself, Susan Franzen. The reason we're together today is that we took a road trip together, and it's probably the most complicated road trip we've ever taken. Paul, maybe you can set the stage.
Well, I guess the idea started at a Ragtime for Randall concert when somebody told you about the Thursday morning breakfast at Chipley School.
Yeah, they said it was a not to miss. When I told you, you agreed that breakfast would be a good road trip for us. And when Gina co-hosted with me on the Kate Shelley program, I told her.
Yes, that sure was a fun trip.
I found it as a bed and breakfast, and then when I called the bed and breakfast, she said, well, we don't have that anymore. We're selling it. Then I asked her about breakfast. Oh, yes, you can come for Thursday breakfast. So we did.
In the meantime, we learned a lot about schools in Iowa. We had a program about one- and two-room country schools, and then we explored school consolidation in 1959. And we met with parents who homeschooled their children, too.
One of the things we learned was that people who talked to us had found fond memories of their schools, whatever size they were. But the most amazing to us was the story we discovered of Shipley School.
And just to let you know where we're going after Shipley, there are two Mexican restaurants in Nevada, and we'll find out about those.
And then after that, we're going to celebrate National Bicycle Month with a visit from Lisa Hine with the Iowa Heritage Foundation, telling us about the bicycle trails around Story County and beyond. All right, so let's get to Shipley.
Okay, well, we actually made more than one trip to with the Shipley group. The first was about a year ago. We went down in the early summer. I noticed it was June. And the school, which you can see on the website, is huge, and it's very hard to find. I got lost. Did anybody else get lost going down there?
Well, it's not the most obvious place to find.
No.
But I was impressed with the condition of the school and then learning something about the history of the school, you know. And, Susan, you can fill us in on some of that stuff. Like, why was it built in the first place?
Well, it was built because they were doing away with the one- and two-room country schools. And so they had to have a place for the country school children to go. And the most amazing thing to me about Shipley was that the town of Shipley had disbanded already in 1911. It was only founded in 1902 because there was a railroad going through. But it's way after the railroad boom. And actually, Mr. Shipley, I learned from the school historian Nancy Ryder, that Mr. Shipley went on to become a businessman in Ames. But Shipley just died on the vine. You know, they platted it and nobody built houses. And so they gave up in about 10 years. And when they had to pass the bond issues for the schools, these are the schools that you see, like the school on Highway 30 over on the Lincoln Highway, and that's North Grant. And North Grant bond issue was passed the same time as Shipley. And Shipley was actually, it was North Grant and South Grant for the kids who lived in the within 10 miles. And they didn't even know where they were going to build the school. They only had about a little over 100 voters. But it was a landmark because in this 1916 election, there were women voters. About a third of the voters were women. And, of course, this is before suffrage. Obviously, women ought to get to vote on a school bond issue, don't you think? And so then they said, okay, we're going to build one over on the Lincoln Highway, and we've got to get another one down south part of the township. This is Grant Township. And so they just said, well, Shipley's a good place.
And so they built the school. And what's the date on that, Susan? When did they build it?
1919.
Right after World War One.
Yeah, by the time it was finally built.
And then the kids who attended there, what geographic area was that?
About 10-mile radius around the school.
And it closed when?
Well, it actually closed in 59 when the big consolidation happened. Now, this was always, from the day one until it closed, the full range of elementary and high school. It was K through high school, and then there was a period where they didn't have any kindergarten. But they always had high school. But they had very tiny graduating classes. The last one was 3. But that wasn't the only little one. The only really big one they had was when they had a poor teacher in the 8th grade and the kids couldn't pass their 8th grade examination to go into high school, so they had to repeat. Then they had 18 or 19 students graduating in 1937 because it was a double class.
Well, now, they had a big addition to the school in 1939. They built the gymnasium. That was a WPA project.
And that was why it was built. They had the government money to do it, and it was really wonderful for that community because the school was their community place. I mean, in some places, it was their community was built around a church, but this was around the school. The parents had entertainments for when they had their monthly community meetings. So it was more than just the kids getting together. Well, you'll hear what they have to say about that.
I thought it was really fun that they had the buckboard wagons as the school buses. They went around with those, and sometimes it was driven by a 14- or 15-year-old.
Let's get the first memories from the people that we talked to at the Shipley breakfast.
My grandpa drove a bus for the Shipley School, and he built the first motorized school bus in Story County. He added an old truck chassis to the horse-drawn buggy that they picked up the kids in. Shipley was just a real family area. Several of the children that I went to school with and went through at Shipley were children of the parents who had graduated with my parents. So we had, I think, at least four kids in my class whose parents had met at Shipley, gotten married, and their kids were at Shipley also.
Wow.
So it was, we mostly a farm community, and everybody continued farming and stuck right out around in the area. So we all knew each other very well, and we didn't know each other just from school. We went to each other's houses for supper and played together after school and things like that. So it was just a real family community. Pretty great.
See, the grade school was already there, but when they built the gymnasium, the new gymnasium, my father took the job to dig the basements for the shower rooms. And he hired neighbors in the community with a team of horses and slip scraper. That's how that basement was all. And the dirt was put out in front of the gymnasium. That's why.
Oh, it sits up high.
Yeah. And one of the things I remembered, there was an old merry-go-round there. Well, that ended up where the shower rooms were. So they got all the dirt away from it, but they had to get it up out of the hole. So our hired man we had for 11 years, he brought the F-20 tractor down there, and they hooked on it. And it wouldn't pull it. The front end reared up. So they had two guys set up on the radiator. Well, then the hind wheels dug down, so then they put a team of horses on ahead of the tractor. They got it pulled up out of there.
Oh, my goodness. That was one of the mornings at the Thursday breakfast, and I got to record Joyce Peterson and also Ivan Jensen, who had gone to school there and had many fond memories.
Well, talking about fond memories, I really enjoy the stories about the pranks the boys pulled. That's probably typical of today, too. There's one told by Joyce Peterson about her grandfather, and another one by Bob Sweeney. I think we have that one recorded.
Yeah.
About my dad. He talks about the things they used to do on Halloween and stuff like that. And today, that would probably be considered vandalism.
What they used to do.
Well, one of the stories he tells is about the time they took the neighbor's wagon apart, took it piece by piece up on top of the corn crib and put it back together again and left it up there. When the farmer came out, his wagon was on top of the corn crib.
One of the memories I have here is we called it running the bolt. There was a big bolt that went through the wall up in the boys' restroom into the music room. And some of the older boys taught me to climb up on the sink and run that bolt back and forth. There was a nut and a washer that made all kinds of racket in the music room. The music teacher came in and drug me off the sink, and I don't remember whether I got a paddling then or not. I probably did. I don't remember that part, but
you want to?
That's a lot of hijinks.
Yeah, I thought you'd like to announce those, since I imagine you have a few of your own.
Well, there's all kinds of pranks people pull. That was that's really very intricate that he reassembled that on top of the crib. That's dangerous work. They'll go to great lengths, I think. But, you know, besides the nostalgia that comes up, we all have around our school days, and, you know, look at this Shipley School having disappeared so long ago. For some reason, Shipley refused to die after the students left in 1959, and we have this great tradition of getting together all the time at Shipley.
That's right, and they even have a class historian. I uncovered the story about why it didn't die yesterday. This has been the longest running show to prepare. We went a year ago, and then we went last week, where they're now meeting at Hy-Vee. The school is closed, and they tried to sell it, and it didn't sell, and there's a little bit more there. But let's hear about that from Nancy Reiter, the class historian, and from Wanda Kemp, the owner.
Did this incredible community bridge the 50-year gap between the time the school closed and the time the coffee started? Were they still having reunions every year?
Oh, yes. The Shipley banquet was every year in June. And as far as I know, that has gone on forever. Every year, it's the second Saturday of June. Ed and Wanda were both from Northeast Iowa. They had come down here and they rented a house from Lawrence Jordan. Ed was going to college at that time, and they were raising their family over there. And then they moved to Huxley, and then the schoolhouse had sat empty, and they came back and bought it.
Ed wanted me to go for a ride, and we came over to the Shipley Schoolhouse. It was for sale. We contacted a realtor, went through a tour of the schoolhouse, and walking up the ramp, I said, I guess maybe I could live in a place like this. And that's all it took. Ed was sold. We put in an offer, and we got it. We ended up over here the day after Christmas of 99, and we've been here ever since. He just liked a large place that he could restore trucks. He was into tractors. He liked radios. He liked anything that had moving parts to it. He loved generators, wind chargers. Ed loved it all. And this was a nice big space, had the gym, which did not have the floor in it anymore, worked great for him. Anyway, he was a collector, and I guess I'm a collector because I fill the inside. We got together with some friends, and we had such a good time. We decided that we should get together at least for coffee once a week. So that's when we started our coffee out here. It was on Thursdays, and it was strictly by word of mouth. Nancy came in after she retired, which was in what year? 07, you retired.
I retired in May of 07.
And when she retired, she started coming out here to coffee. Coffee started in 04, and I said it would be nice to have a Shipley book, even if it was this big, which is about maybe a quarter of an inch. Nancy took on the task, and she came up with our Shipley book, which is about 2 inches thick. Nancy's the one that got us started at the quilting out here. A very dear friend of ours lost her daughter, has lost two daughters, and one of her daughters was into quilting for missions. And she had a lot of fabric that her daughter had collected over the years, and she was overwhelmed with what to do with it and what to do with all the quilts that her daughter had started. And Nancy said to me one day, why don't we help Kathy out with these quilts? So we got together on a Tuesday, because Thursday was already taken, and we began putting Mary Beth's quilts together. And using her fabrics, we've been quilting ever since. Every Tuesday, we wouldn't miss it. It's a best friends club, quilting club.
And I went to that last Tuesday, yesterday, and that's where I recorded those. That was from Nancy Ryder, the class historian, and from Wanda Kemp. But you can tell, she's not only the co-owner, but she loves both the quilters and the coffee drinkers, and she makes it possible. There's a very poignant part to this story, because when Ed moved there, when Wanda moved there, she was married to Ed, and you can tell the affection in her voice. And incidentally, that school building is 16,000 square feet, so there's lots of place for collections, and it is really beautiful. As she's right, she takes care of the inside, so there are all kind of antiques around. I mean, in tasteful places, and it's beautifully taken care of. And the businesses, which we don't have time to discuss, the reason that it was in pretty good shape when they bought it in 1999 after having closed 40 years or before, was that it had a couple businesses in there, and they had put a huge amount of money into office space and carpeting. But since this was the 70s, there's a lot of orange carpet, but it's in excellent condition, beautiful oak woodwork. And so there was something to work that they had to work with. And fortunately, since Ed liked to tinker, he put in 4 geothermal units so that they could afford to heat this 16,000 square feet. But he has since died, and one of the people I talked to felt that the coffees were very important in his final years and this as a support group.
Well, my name's Stan Tweet, and I've been one of the charter members of this, where we started so many years ago, and it's taken on a life of its own. But it started out as a support group for Ed, and then we just kept growing and growing. And it's such a unique group. You never know when you come here who you might be sitting and talking to for the whole time. It could be a woman. It could be a man, which is not normal either, is to have a mixed group like this, and a mixed group as far as different careers. Because we have all the way from, I don't know, it's like the whole spectrum up and down, and we all seem to get along after all these years. And it used to be to where, even if Ed and Wanda, or like now with Bill, even if they weren't here, they'd just usually leave the door unlocked, and whoever got here first would fix the coffee. So it was kind of like our place. It wasn't just their place. It's just been super. It's kind of tough seeing it go.
So you said it was a support group for Ed. Who was Ed, and why did he need a support group?
Ed was Wanda's first husband, and he ended up getting cancer. And so what happened is that he got cancer he got diagnosed, I think it was in June, and about in August or September, I don't remember exactly, but we decided to start to get together on Thursday morning. And at first, it was just kind of a casual get-together. If it worked, it worked. If it didn't, it didn't. But then, as it took on a life of its own, it got to the point where nobody hardly ever missed. And he was basically considered terminal and just months to live. And as it turned out, I think he lived 5 more years. And so it worked out to where we kept coming and coming. And actually, I think we lost a couple other members before Ed passed away. And then after Ed passed away, a lot of people thought that, well, this is not going to last. But it's been another, I think, 3 years since then that we still keep doing this.
Yeah, well, in those 3 years, Wanda remarried a friend of Ed's, Bill, who knew the group. Bill and Ed were in a machine club together, so he was able to take over a lot of the work, and they both became widowed about the same time, so they had been friends. So that was why it continued to go on. And I should mention, though, this building, the school in itself is a phenomenon because most schools that are that old have not been so consistently cared for. But this was cared for also by the community. And I'm not sure that we have all of that recorded that we were going to play. But after Ed died, they wanted to make it a bed and breakfast so they could have quilt gatherings there. But they had to clean up the yard because that collection that he had, I think she didn't mention he also had a fire truck, and I think the county considered this. And so basically the neighbors helped her clean it out. And if you look on the website, you'll see it's spotless now.
I think the main thing about this whole project is the fact that so many good things came together. The business invested in it to make it a more beautiful setting indoors, to do all the woodworking and refurbish all the rooms. And that really enabled the couple there to have a home, you know, to live in, a nice modern home. But the interesting thing is, behind all that is a regulation gym and stage, you know, the typical setup that was built by the WPA, a full-size gymnasium. So all kinds of things that Ed had, he could put in there. There's still a lot of stuff back there. Just imagine living in a place that once was a school, and you'd have hallways and rooms that would be a normalized-type house. But behind all that is a full-size, you know, a gymnasium. By full-size, I mean 1939 standards. That's part of the building, too. So it's a unique structure. And you know, you always say some real estate's hard to move, but here's Ed and Wanda who really wanted that place, and they bought it, and now they made a house out of it. And then Bill, after Ed's death, had married Wanda, and they're living there too. And now they're at a point where they want to do some traveling and be freed up, and so it's on the market again. But it's just a lot of unique things came together. And the coffee group, the support group for Ed, you know, this has morphed into this Shipley group that still meets, except they meet at Hy-Vee here in Ames now on Thursdays. And so we have all these ties that bind people. And it's just a great story. It's a story of Ed and Wanda and Bill, but also a story of Shipley and the school and all the ties that bind those folks who have an identity with that place. So this has all been a very fascinating project for that reason.
It has been, and the stories do go on. But just in case anybody is curious, the amount of work that not just Wanda but Ed did on that building is incredible, besides the forced geothermal furnaces. They did a lot of other work. And if people are curious about the building, go online and look on Zillow, because you can see the specs and you can see what it looks like. And it's not for sale at the moment. They need to do a little more work to put it back on the market. Because it's very, as you say, it's a very unusual property. This is not like a 16,000-foot mansion. Mm-hmm. This is like something you have to do. You find something to do with this for some kind of community. But it's really fun to look at it. So I recommend that for anybody who's so inclined.
And we have a little bit here from Wanda, okay?
A little philosophy,
A little
yes.
philosophy from Wanda.
Yes.
It's there. It's just a warm feeling, I guess.
It's country people. Country people are different than city people. I'm sorry, but country people are different. And that's good to us. And I hope the people come away with the feeling that it's a good place out here. And it doesn't have to be Shipley. You can make your own community wherever you are, as long as you accept people for who they are and work with them.
I was driving late with my radio into that old Nashville station, when I heard a song from long ago. Through the static, it caught my attention. The fiddle wept and the guitar cried, and the singer sang with a sigh. And the years rolled like a stone from me down the road
listening to KHOI Community Radio 89.1, where hosts Paul Wearson, Susan Franson, and Gina McAndrews. We've been visiting the rural Story County area and the community surrounding Shipley School in particular. And now we'll hear from KHOI intern Jasmine Merguia about two Mexican restaurants in Nevada. From rural Iowa to a Mexican community, let's listen to what Jasmine discovered on her journey.
Nevada, Iowa, a city of nearly 6,800 residents, with about 233 Latinos in the city, one question comes to mind. Why is there two Mexican restaurants literally one block away from each other? I went to Nevada to discover just that. I spoke with Martin Fuentes, owner of Mi Casita, and Miguel Tony Espinosa, owner of El Jinete, to discuss the history of each restaurant and the Latino population in Nevada. First off, you will listen in on the interview with Martin Fuentes, owner of Mi Casita restaurant in Nevada, Iowa. Mi Casita was the very first Mexican restaurant to open in Nevada and has been dishing out their best plates for nearly 12 years. Fuentes has lived in Iowa for 15 years, but I learned that the reason for coming to Iowa was to open a restaurant, La Carreta, in Boone with a friend. Fuentes, 2 years later, decided to take on another Mexican restaurant in Nevada, Iowa, with Mi Casita.
Mi nombre es Martin Fuentes y tengo 15 años viviendo aquí en Iowa. Yo vengo de Nevada, del estado de Nevada.
Okay.
Sí, de Carson City, Nevada. Yo vine aquí porque me...
My name is Martin Fuentes.
Un amigo mío.
I've lived in Nevada, Iowa for 15 years.
Primero aquí, en Boone.
I'm originally from Carson City, Nevada.
Y La Carreta.
I moved to Nevada, Iowa because a friend invited me to open a restaurant in Boone, Iowa. We opened up a carrete and soon after we opened a restaurant in Nevada, Iowa.
And so I decided to ask him, why did he decide to open up Mi Casita in Nevada, Iowa?
Pues, por lo mismo, como hay había manera de abrir ahí.
He said for the same reason he decided to open up a restaurant in Carson City, Nevada. There was opportunity to do so, and so he did.
¿Qué fue la reacción de los que viven allí? ¿Había muchos latinos en ese tiempo?
Sí, ahí ha habido todo el tiempo latinos.
He said that 12 years ago when he opened up Mi Casita, there were a lot of Latinos and there still continues to be a large population of Latinos in Nevada, Iowa.
Tenemos más clientela americana.
But he does have more American clients rather than Hispanics.
Oh, Jalisco.
Yeah, okay.
Sí.
Hay tradiciones que traen al restaurante que pueden...
And in his restaurant, you can see a traditional Jalisciense Mexican artistry in his restaurant, a type of style in there that is from the state of Jalisco in Mexico.
He says
there's a lot of artisan artistry, a lot of vivid paintings and clay sculptures.
Son los como los cuadros muy coloridos. De color, muchas figuras de barro, sí, artesanía de México. Pues más bien es de, como de México.
Okay.
Sí.
¿Y se puede reflejar Jalisco en la comida?
No.
No. Okay. ¿Qué se puede ver en la comida?
No, la comida.
And I asked him if we could see this Jalisciense traditional type of influence in the Mexican
americano,
food that he serves in his restaurant. And this is what he said.
Americano.
¿Y por qué dice eso? Que es más para americano.
No,
que para
porque the food in Mi Casita is more Tex-Mex style. It is less spicy.
Sí.
Us as Mexicans, we love spicy
toda esta comida
food.
Es más que
but
nada,
we don't serve it so spicy in our restaurants.
Picosa. Para lo americano. En Nevada, en el estado de Iowa, digo de Nevada, sí abrimos un restaurante primero, pero no nos fue muy bien.
Okay.
Y se cerró, entonces fue cuando decidimos abrir en Boone.
Before venturing out to Iowa, Fuentes had originally tried his luck opening up a restaurant in Carson City, Nevada. That business failed.
Y aquí hay más, está más accesible para restaurantes.
Yes.
Okay,
in Nevada, there is much more competition with Mexican restaurants. And here in Iowa,
todo el tiempo
it is more successful to open
yo.
Up a restaurant.
Tengo como 35 años trabajando en restaurante.
Fuentes has been working in the restaurant business for 35 years. He started out washing dishes, later became a cook, and then a waiter.
Y luego enseguida
he was very humble to say that he feels the same after owning his own restaurants. He said it is work that he continues to enjoy throughout
the years.
También
pues trabajo de mesero y de lo que se pueda.
¿Y cómo se siente ser dueño de dos restaurantes?
Igual.
¿Igual?
Sí, no hay diferencia. Es trabajo.
He says there is no difference, the work is the same, and he enjoys it every
day. Compartir su cultura mexicana con los demás, con los americanos. Por lo menos la comida.
Sí, pues de hecho acaba de pasar el 5 de mayo.
He said he enjoys sharing his Mexican culture with the rest of Nevada, Iowa.
Y los americanos les gusta ir a comer y todo.
The 5th of May, for Cinco de Mayo celebrations, he did throw on a special celebration at Mi Casita and his other restaurants. He had special sales where, you know, other people could come and enjoy and just enjoy the food and the drinks that he had to serve.
Porque pues a los americanos les gusta, como uno pone especiales y eso, los americanos celebran el 5 de mayo. Y el hispano mexicano pues como que no lo se festeja como en México.
And although Hispanics ourselves, we don't celebrate Cinco de Mayo very often here in Iowa. Americans love to enjoy it, and so he puts on this as a celebration for them and a celebration where that they can
enjoy. En Boone no hay mucha población hispana. Prácticamente casi hay nada más los que trabajan en el restaurante y como unas dos o tres familias más. En Nevada.
I continued to ask him more about the Latino population in Nevada, Iowa. He told me that there are quite a lot of Hispanics in Nevada for the size that it is.
Pues, tal vez hay poquito más ahorita. Pero es que,
perhaps there are more now, no hay, but since in Nevada there are no foundations of jobs, especially for Hispanics. There was a packing plant near Nevada, but when that closed down, people went looking for jobs outside of Nevada. There were a lot of Hispanics when the packing plant was there. I'm not sure if the population has grown, but those are those who stayed now work outside of Nevada. When the packing plant was there, the restaurant had a lot of Hispanic clients. I thought it was a bad idea that the packing plant had closed down because there were no more jobs for the people of Nevada, not just
Hispanics.
And finally, I asked him, what was it that he wanted to tell the Ames and surrounding communities? He said that, well, the restaurant is open there, they will be there, open arms, ready to serve everyone. I want to leave this interview on the note that Martin Fuentes was a very humble man that was very calm in his demeanor. I could tell that he has enjoyed working in the restaurant business. As you, the listener, has heard, Fuentes has had great opportunities to open up Mexican restaurants around central Iowa. I also interviewed a new face to the Mexican scene in Nevada, Iowa. Tony Espinosa has ventured into the restaurant business after working as a waiter for 7 years. He is originally from Michoacán, Mexico, and moved to Des Moines, Iowa to take up a job. He soon decided to open up his own restaurant. He tells us how his new business adventure has been so far.
I simply just wanted to try out my luck, and Nevada seemed like a good location to do it. It was a good idea, lots of traffic, good people here. Business has been good so far.
Okay, ¿y desde cuándo tiene abierto?
Desde marzo 16.
Okay, ¿y cómo está el negocio?
Pues bien.
Bien.
Ahí va el pasito, sí.
Okay, ¿y de dónde
El Jinete Restaurant has been open since March 16.
¿Entonces podemos ver su comida aquí en el restaurante?
Sí.
De Michoacán. ¿Cuál es su plato favorito?
Las carnitas.
Carnitas
y... carnitas
I am from Michoacán, Mexico.
Okay.
My favorite dish to prepare is carnitas.
¿Cómo se prepara ya?
Se prepara con... se sirve con arroz, frijol, lechuga, guacamole, jalapeños... y carnitas, que es viene siendo la carne de res guisada con cebolla, tortillas, chiles.
¿Y siempre ha sido un sueño de usted abrir un restaurante?
Sí.
O
pues sí, mire, lo que pasa es trabajar.
¿Y empezó en México con los restaurantes?
No, aquí.
I continue to ask him more about his favorite dishes and about his favorite food that he likes to serve at the restaurant. But then I started to wonder, why was this always a dream of his, and how did this all start?
¿Y qué es lo que ha aprendido en todo su tiempo trabajando en restaurantes?
He aprendido mucho a tratar bien a la gente.
I was a waiter for more than 7 years, and I have always dreamed of having something I could call my own.
Inglés.
I worked washing dishes, cooking, waiting
inglés.
Tables.
De mesero.
I've learned how to treat people, and I learned English.
Y limpiaba mesas. Que la mismos clientes
I was a little shy waiting on American clients because I didn't know English.
Y me daba pena porque no sabía.
¿Cuántos años tenía cuando?
Tenía 16 años.
Okay.
No, ya tenía 17 años.
He was 17
years old when he moved to Des Moines, Iowa, to start working as a waiter and washing dishes and started this whole venture on the restaurant business. I then asked him how it feels to finally have his own restaurant after so many years.
It feels good. It's a lot of pressure at the beginning. Investing your money and all though money in the long run isn't something very important. The important thing is accomplishing your goals and that you have to set yourself. And God has helped along the way. Because of this, it wouldn't work out. Just thank God. Gave me this chance to have something to call my own for a while, and I'm just happy and grateful.
Compartir su cultura con los demás.
¿Cómo qué tipo de cultura?
O sea, su cultura mexicana de Michoacán, así, su comida y todo eso. Como
I asked him if it's important for him to share his culture with the Nevada community. And he said, yes, of course, this is a traditional Mexican restaurant, but we have our own seasoning and we add our own touches to the food.
Lo tradicional que uno acostumbra a comer en su pueblo, en su estado, en su ciudad, lo que sea. Y ya le agrega unos cositas más que a la gente también le van gustando. Uno mismo va mirando al transcurso del tiempo qué es lo que les gusta, qué no les gusta. Hacer cambios para mejorar.
He said he likes making changes for the better.
¿Y cómo ha respondido el pueblo de Nevada?
Pues bien, sí, gracias a Dios.
He said the Nevada community has responded well.
Algunas personas, si no hay cosas en el menú, pero mientras lo podamos hacer, si lo cocinamos... Pues todo, porque como ves el bar yo lo hice, yo lo construí.
Eso leí también, que ¿cómo fue eso, construyendo el bar?
Construimos el bar.
¿De dónde fue la idea?
Pues lo que pasa es que aquí...
There is one feature, though, in his restaurant that he is excited to show the community, and that is the bar that he has built from the ground up. He said that he saw the space available in the restaurant, in the location he found, and so he created this bar, and he hopes to have this be a fun atmosphere where people can come and just drink. He says that he noticed the same thing, that Hispanics are here for jobs, and when there is no jobs, there might not be a larger population. But he says he likes Nevada, it's a peaceful place and a nice atmosphere to live in. And if this restaurant business, his restaurant venture goes well, he plans to move to Nevada, hopefully, and be in the community.
Servirle a la gente como le gusta comer. No dar poquito por mucho, sino que más o menos lo que se varía por el platillo, ¿sí me entiendes?
Okay. Y por último, ¿qué es lo que quiere decir al pueblo de Nevada o al pueblo de Ames?
And lastly, I asked him what he would like to say to the Ames community.
Pues que muchas gracias y que como quiera a los clientes que nos han estado apoyando, que Dios los bendiga y que pues no nos olviden, que aquí estamos para servirle cualquier cosa y pues que gracias por recibir al jinete como un nuevo... Se podría decir algún nuevo business para el pueblo. Y pues, que muchas gracias.
He says thank you to all of you who have supported their business so far. There you have it. Two distinct histories of starting a Mexican restaurant in Nevada, Iowa. One with a long-standing tradition and the other with new and hopeful ventures in the community. All statistics shared today are received from suburbanstats.org. Thank you to Tony and Martin for sharing their history and the culture of their restaurants.
Por la lejana montaña va cabalgando un jinete, vaga solito en el mundo.
Okay, right now, after you have an enjoyable meal over in Nevada one of these days, we're going to leave Nevada right now and look beyond our county to the bicycle trails throughout our listening area and beyond. For those that didn't know, this is National Bicycle Month, and we're going to be celebrating here in Ames this Friday, May 22nd, with the Cycle Cinema Night. And it's going to start at 6 o'clock, beginning at the fountain in front of the Memorial Union. So people are going to meet there and then ride downtown and be there by 7 o'clock at the Panatorium. And that's where KHOY Studios, where we're going to be partnering with the Ames Bicycle Coalition to host a screening of a variety of informational short films on examples of livable streets from all over the country. And then after the films, the citizens and bicyclists and city officials are invited to a constructive discussion on how a city can be accessible by all transportation types. And as a reminder, that's this Friday from 6 to 8.
On Friday, May 22nd, yes. But any day that weather permits is a good day to explore the many great bike trails in the heart of Iowa. Ursula Rudenberg has an interview now with Lisa Hine of the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation, and they're going to tell us about all these great opportunities.
This is Ursula Rudenberg for Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio, and I'm here with Lisa Hine from the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. Hi, Lisa. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the Natural Heritage Foundation does?
Sure. Thanks. The Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation has been around since 1979, and we are a nonprofit land conservation organization. So we actually work throughout the entire state of Iowa in helping to protect lands that become wildlife areas, habitat, county parks, state parks. We help communities work on projects that help protect natural areas and groundwater and things like that. And because of our experience in land protection and land acquisition, early on we got involved in helping acquire discontinued railroad corridors. Some of the very first trail projects that we were involved in include Cedar Valley Nature Trail that runs from Cedar Falls and Waterloo to Cedar Rapids, the Heritage Trail, which is runs outside of Dubuque, the Raccoon River Valley Trail, the Wabash Trace Nature Trail, 63 miles in southwest Iowa. And the trails are a great way for people to get outside and enjoy nature, and then hopefully that will lead to a greater awareness of the overall need to protect our environment and protect the Iowa landscape.
One of the most spectacular is the High Trestle Bridge. For anybody who has seen it, especially at night, it's an unforgettable sight. Can you describe a little bit what is on the High Trestle Bridge?
The High Trestle Bridge is part of the High Trestle Trail, and the High Trestle Trail runs from Ankeny through Slater, Madrid, over to Woodward. So it's 25 miles. The bridge itself spans the Des Moines River Valley between Madrid and Woodward. So it sits 13 stories in the air, and it's a half mile long. It was part of the Union Pacific Railroad corridor that was discontinued in about 2003. When the railroad discontinued use, they took down the decking to use at their new bridge that was going in over the Des Moines River near Boone, part of their main line that runs through Ames. And so we were left with, I think it's 44 pillars across the river valley. So there were pillars that were left, but no way, no connections. So part of the project was actually having to rebuild the bridge surface and the bridge deck.
So how did it become a bike trail and a hiking trail?
Yeah. When Union Pacific Railroad planned for the discontinuance of that line, we stepped in to negotiate the purchase of that line for public use, and they provided a significant bargain sale to us, so they contributed a lot of land value. Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation formed a steering committee made up of representatives from Ankeny, Sheldahl, Slater, Madrid, and Woodward, and Story County, Boone County, Dallas County, and Polk County. So the steering committee worked together, and we helped guide them to find grant dollars to help build the trail. The first two sections built in about 2006 were a mile in Ankeny and a half mile or less in Woodward. And in 2006, Congress authorized a special appropriation for this project of a little over $5 million. That was the spark that really gave us the leverage to build a large section of it. And I think what really put the icing on the cake was the art. I got the idea of putting art on trail bridges from the folks down in Fairfield, Iowa. They're involving artists on their trail bridges, and they got the idea from Tucson, Arizona. So I suggested to the committee, what do you think of this idea? Let's see about putting some art on the bridge. And they're like, sure, that sounds great. David Dahlquist, the public artist that you see a lot of his work across Iowa, he was selected by the committee, and he did the concepts for what we call cribs, the square shapes that are lit up. There's a lot of coal mining history in this part of the river valley. So that square shape is based on what you would see entering a coal mine. And then he rotated it so that it would give some interest. There's pillars on each end, about 40 foot tall pillars on each end.
With coal on them.
Yeah, seams of coal that have been actually clay tile that Dahlquist created. And the cribs go across the entire bridge, but over the river valley, they're about 15 feet apart. And that's the part that's lit up. So, and that's, it rotates all across the bridge, but that part is very dense, and that's where the main.
And so when you stand there at night, the mm-hmm. cribs are lit up with thin blue line, mm-hmm. neon lines. And when you stand at one end, the rotating images look like you're looking down a mine shaft. It creates an optical illusion.
Mm-hmm.
I never would have thought it would work with such a simple, such a simple construct of just some squares.
Mm-hmm.
But it really does.
Mm-hmm. It's a pretty amazing story.
Well, and it also has to be said, the view is very spectacular.
It is. And there's some neat geology from the Des Moines River Valley. The melting of the glaciers 10,000 years ago really helped carve the Des Moines River Valley. And there's also the coal mining history in there as well. And there's some interesting railroad history. Before they built the bridges, they had to go down into the river valley and kind of curve and come up. And a lot of times they would derail and they'd get down to the bottom and have to sort of haul one car at a time up the valley on the other side. So it was very cumbersome and slow going. And mm-hmm. about 1912, the Milwaukee line, which owned the railroad at the time, came in and built all new bridges across that area. So mm-hmm. there are some interpretive panels that are out on the bridge itself that tell a little bit about the natural history and as well as the cultural history, the railroad history of that corridor in the river valley, so folks will find that interesting as well.
And there's historical photographs of the bridge
Absolutely.
Itself.
And there's a neat overlook, actually. That's the other interesting part about the bridge is on the west end of the bridge, there's an scenic overlook that was part of the first railroad bridge. And so there's an area for people to gather, and there's picnic tables and things like that. Okay.
And I think by the overlook, there's a station where you can phone in for mm-hmm. historical information.
Mm-hmm. You know, the Des Moines River Valley itself is spectacular, and this bridge would be a showstopper just because of Mother Nature and being 13 stories high over the Des Moines River. And the art just takes it over the top and it makes it a world-class icon now.
It's a magical site, and one of the things that makes it magical is that you can't really drive up to it.
The easiest way to get there is to get on Highway 210, which runs between Madrid and Woodward, and also goes through Slater. And just west of Madrid, there's a road called QF Lane, and there's a sign that says High Trestle Trail Parking. And so you turn south off of 210, and there's a parking area, and it's about a half-mile walk in to the bridge. Or you can take your bicycle, and it's wheelchair accessible. And there's even somebody in Madrid that has a supply of wheelchairs. So, like, for example, my mom, she's not in a wheelchair, but she's old enough that half a mile is a pretty hard walk for her. I can borrow a wheelchair and take her out there. That's the easiest way. Or you can bicycle. Heck, you can bicycle from Ames. You can get on a bicycle and take the bike lanes down the County Line Road, R38. That takes you to Slater. Get on the trail in Slater and bike all the way over to the bridge. Round trip, it's about 50 miles. It's a nice little Saturday afternoon bike ride for a lot of folks.
How many people use the trail?
The bridge itself receives about 500 people a day,
wow.
And there's probably about 300 on the rest of the trail, 200 to 300 people a day.
So what kind of things do people say about the bridge and that trail?
It's magical. I think that's probably the one thing I hear. You mentioned it earlier, that it's just magical. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to describe. One time I was out there, and there was a gentleman from Coon Rapids, and he was in his upper 80s, and it was a very windy day. And the wind comes down that river valley a lot anyway. But he was walking, holding onto the railing, hand over fist, you know, walking into these 30-mile-an-hour gusts. And my husband and I came along and we were like, do you need some help? And he's like, no, this is the best time of my life. I'm having so much fun. I'm picking my ride up on the other side of the bridge, and I'm determined to get across there. And he was just having a blast.
So did the biking culture in Iowa take a step forward with this bridge?
I think biking and walking and just being outdoors, that whole aspect took a big leap forward, because we build so many places for our cars, we don't always build places for people. And in this case, being way up high at the top of the river valley where you can be out there without any vehicles, it's just a wonderful way to experience nature and watch the birds fly above you and below you. And it's just Iowa outdoors, I think, took a big leap forward with this project. And I think the other exciting thing about this project is economic development that's occurred in some of the communities. There's folks from all over Iowa and the Midwest and the country that come to see this trail and experience trails in Iowa as a whole, because we like to promote Iowa as the world capital of trails. We've got thousands of miles of trails in the state, and it's just amazing. You know, it's been said years ago, Iowa doesn't have mountains like Colorado and doesn't have oceans like the coasts, but we have an amazing trail system, and we've really worked hard over the last 20, 30 years to develop the trail system. High Trestle Trail is just, you know, it wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for the other trails that have come before it. And but this one has seen new restaurants in Woodward, and I think about three new restaurants in Madrid, a new restaurant in Slater. Ankeny is trying to develop a whole new trail access point with a farmer's market area built around the main trail access point. So there's a lot going on, and I really look forward to the businesses in the communities realizing how much this trail brings in, and looking forward to them being creative and getting trail users off the trail and into their towns. And it is exciting.
Where is a good place to get information about the bridge online?
Sure. You folks can go to our website, which is inhf.org. inhf.org, which is Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation.org. Folks can call our office. That number is 515-288-1846.
They can repeat it.
515-288-1846.
Where can one get a bicycle map of the state for trails?
The Iowa Department of Transportation publishes a bicycling map for Iowans, and it outlines the traffic counts on the road. So if you want to use county road and bike on a low-traveled road, so it gives traffic counts, and it also identifies where the trails are. And certainly folks can go to our website and look for trail information there.
Well, thank you so much for coming. I've been speaking with Lisa Hine, who's with the Natural Heritage Foundation, which is based out of Des Moines, speaking about biking trails in Iowa and the bike culture that's growing up around it on a new level with the High Trestle Trail. Thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming.
This is KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, and today your hosts have been Paul Wearson, Gina McAndrews, and Susan Franson, exploring the amazing history and spirit of people from Shipley School, and we were talking with Nancy Ryder, Wanda Kemp, Stan Tweet, Joyce Peterson, and Ivan Jensen. Then Jasmine Murgia took us on a culinary and cultural tour of two Mexican restaurants in Nevada. And we heard Ursula Rudenberg's interview with Lisa Hine of the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation.
The show was engineered by
Rebecca Ryder. She just got married.
Oh, Ryder, that's right. She
congratulations,
got married last
Rebecca.
Saturday. The music you heard was Used to Be by Robin and Linda Williams from their CD Deeper Waters. And Bicycle Race by Queen. Our theme song, Backtracking, by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Local Talk, like all KHOI programs, is now streaming live on KHOIFM.org. You can also link to our programs from our webpage, where there will be links to the individuals and organizations mentioned in our show. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a radio show. You can join the team as a reporter by calling 515-292-2878 or at khoifm.org.
Your support as a listener or as a contributor is what makes KHOI possible. Thanks for listening now, and see you again
on the radio.